Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. We had a technical glitch, so we're actually doing this first couple of minutes for the second time. But I'm here with David Lane. Hello.
Hi, how's it going? I know you're good because you said that earlier you were good. So
this is interesting. Well, I'm going to have to rewind my brain. But can you tell the audience a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
Yes, no problem. So our little business is Osher Automotive and Workshop 77. We've probably had, I suppose, a bit more traction with Workshop 77 in certain areas, but we're making more of a concentration now on the Osher Automotive side. We're in our new premises, which are new, 18 months old now, but new to us. And it meant that, you know, it was a good reason to change the business and try and focus on what we were doing. So we build... On the Osher side, we build a bit of a no-compromise type product that we have, concentrating on the 911s, which we've had various bits of traction with and cars that I love. And the other iconic car we're dealing with is Defenders. So that's on the Osher Automotive side. On the Workshop 77 side, we still continue to have a bit of fun, hot rod cars, do some stuff, car stuff, man, car culture.
And when we last spoke, so those of you who've not come across David or the associated Osher or Workshop 77, we did a podcast a while ago. I'll put it in the show notes. We sort of run through a bit of David's journey to getting here and starting the business and whatnot. And last time I think we were on the podcast, we speak every now and then in the middle. So sometimes I disconnect from what we've talked about on the podcast and what we talked about in real life. But I know at the time when you were running into, this is when you were in the old building with the Workshop 77, you were doing lots of projects for lots of different people. And it was all kind of, I think, feel like possibly getting a bit complicated.
Yes.
And the Osher side was sort of growing, but was kind of a smaller part. And I feel like you're now shifting more towards that. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. We were, not only did we have a lot of projects on, but we were doing a lot of sort of prototype type projects. So the development was happening on the customer's car as they were speccing these things. You know, they were coming up with various ideas, engine swaps, gearbox swaps, etc. And we didn't have, there was no sort of prototyping that was done apart from with the client. So if any issues developed, etc., they had to be pretty understanding and go, well, look, we've just done, you know, 1500 miles in this car and we're finding this is an issue in summer now, overheating or whatever it is. And you know, they'd need to then bring it back and do all of that. Whereas now with Osher Automotive, we're able to do all the development on our own cars. So this LT1 swap that we're doing with the 8-speed auto into the Defenders, and we've had it on a mule chassis. We've run it around. We've done over 500 miles driving around our lovely Northamptonshire potholed roads. And we know that it works. So so that sort of takes that stress away from it. We now know what works and what doesn't. And we can develop the product ourselves so that it does work and function properly right out the can.
And how have you picked the various cars that you've done? Because I know you've done 911s. You've done all sorts of different cars.
We've done all sorts, yeah.
But, you know, how do you pick the cars?
Well, now now, I mean, you know, I grew up driving Landys, so I love them. You know, the first time I was driving them, I was probably 10 or 12 years old on the farm in Botswana. We still use them. We've got two Series 2As on the farm. We use them for wildlife conservation, which for me was always a massive passion and continues to be. And I'm sort of trying to pass that on to my little boy who's six now, and he's been out to South Africa twice, total for about 6 weeks of his life. But he tells everybody at his school that he's South African, you know. They can't sort of work it out. But yeah, so he obviously loves it too. So for me, yeah, the Land Rover is very iconic, but Porsches I've always loved. We've had some traction with them. We've built some nice cars. People have appreciated those cars. We've got customers that own some of those cars now and use them fairly frequently. And they love them. And for me, yeah, it's a no-brainer. You know, Land Rovers built just up the road, something I grew up driving, and we think we can engineer it pretty well. And then Porsches, you know, shit, what's not to like about a Porsche? So especially classic Porsches.
Preaching to the choir.
Yeah. The only problem is, of course, that obviously I think a lot of people feel that way because, you know, technically, I suppose, there's a lot of competition. There's so many people doing Porsches and Landys. Well, you know, what else is there? Couple of people doing minis, couple of people doing BMWs, really, kind of, maybe Mercs, maybe, but you know, so that's, I suppose, the problem. But yeah, we wanted to build something that was our own design that worked and engineered well and works well, and it's fun to drive.
And the sort of cynical possible listener or person reading going, okay, you do some 911s, you've done a few different other things. Mm. Why would someone come to you when you sort of spread yourself out? You do a few different things. You do a bit of this, bit of that. And when they're like, well, this company just does 911s.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose we are starting to focus that. We've been through an evolution. I'd say that we're probably at version 3 of ourselves, really. Yeah. You know, we started out, it was just a bit of fun. And it meant that we could do the jobs ourselves and I could do them at trade rates, even on my own cars, because I had been paying retail rates prior to that. And but, you know, we've learned from mistakes we've made along the way, and we evolved slightly. We moved into some new premises out of the original workshop 77 and into building 14, and that changed, and we changed a few times through that. And now we're in our own premises, and, you know, we're version 3 or even maybe even 4. We're concentrating on these two, I suppose, initially, because there's no way I can leave the Porsches behind. We started with the 911s. We had the engines. I got the guys working for me. I understand the engineering behind it really well. You know, Jeremy's ex-Cosworth. So from the engineering point of view for the engine, we thought, well, the LT1 is a perfect thing and we can get that in there. We know we can make it work. And I love Landys. We're concentrating on those two to really, I suppose, develop a product. And I thought a product would be quite nice, a finished product, because this vaporware thing is all easily, you know, but you're trying to sell a concept and an idea to somebody, and you say, yeah, we can customize a view. We can do anything. We can put a unicorn horn on the bonnet if you want, you know, but it was difficult. Now I'm like, well, actually here it is, you know, jump in it, drive it. You can see it. It's demonstrated that it does drive well. It's not just something we'll talk about saying and say it can drive well at some stage or, you know, so, and the product's there. And actually, if you want it now, you can have it now. You know, if you wanted one of the Land Rovers we got downstairs that are completed, you can leave in it immediately if you wanted to.
Yeah. It's interesting that, because like I think anyone that's into cars at some point goes through like I want to modify, I want to change, I want to try different things. And a friend of mine actually who might have got in touch with you. He's not like, he's sort of into cars, but not like
as much as
space on it. And he had an idea for a build. And it was taking, I don't think he'll mind me talking about this because I don't think he's going to do it in the end. He wanted to take an old Rolls and then put a silly engine in it.
Cool.
He was like, I want it to be comfy, but then also have some like real power and that sort of thing. And I spoke to him a little bit about it and was like, okay, it sounds kind of fun. Sounds cool.
Yeah.
But like, I know you don't have unlimited budget. Like, I know this is going to be an expense for you. Actually, can we find a car that sort of from factory sort of fits? So I was like, maybe you want like an older Bentley or something that's a bit more sporty. It's got a bit more power and a bit more hand.
And how old is old? You know, is old like 2000 or is old like 1988 or 1980s?
Like I was looking at like 90s or that sort of age.
Pretty old.
80s, 90s. Kind of old. And I was like, if you put a modern V8 or something, like a Merc V8 or whatever in something from that, you're going to have to do like a lot
Yeah, there is a lot. And as a one-off, you know, this perfectly illustrates the point. It's a prototype car. It could drive well, or it might drive crap.
But no one knows yet.
You will find out once you finish building it and you go down the road and you go, God, that is awful. How do we now engineer some of that awful out? Or maybe you get lucky. Maybe you get lucky and it drives pretty well right out the can. But I don't know. Whereas we know, you know, we're the Defender. We drove it down the road when we had the first LT1 in there and the 8-speed auto. We only had the first 5 gears because of the mapping that we'd done on it. And the boys, I'd found a block of wood under the accelerator. And I said, what's this for? And they said, just so you don't destroy it when you test drive. So you chuck the wood out. But you had to take it nice and easy. But we found out where the pitfalls were. We found out there was a lot of sloppiness. So we put some LSDs into the thing and we make sure that takes the slop out. We've developed it on a product.
Yeah.
And it'll work now. And yeah, so your mate, you know, trying to put up something, you know, I suppose the olden days lazy swap, and I say lazy with the tongue in cheek, but it was always an LS3.
Yeah.
You know, stick an LS3 into a roller and, you know, smoke that. You think, yeah, super cool. It could work, but it might not.
Yeah, it might not. And it
costs a lot of money.
And it's the idea of the constant evolution. Now, as time goes on, I kind of like the idea of that. Like, but picking the right thing and slowly evolving it myself is like my own journey. But
as the car owner and as the person, you know, perhaps, you know, commissioning somebody else to build it, you have to be fully aware and wide-eyed and go into it thinking this could cost hundreds.
And I'm getting none of it back.
And possibly. Yeah, there is that. Yeah, it's not an investment. And you're going to have to work with them. You know, it's got to be a company you can work with because if the goes pear-shaped, you know, you're going to have to go back there and say, look, guys, and they have to be willing to go, yeah, fair enough. You know, the customer wants it this way and this is what it's not doing. And you can't just kick the tires and go, it's a piece of shit anyway and walk away.
Yeah.
You got to fix it.
Yeah, it is. You see it actually quite a lot. I think it's probably made, social media is a perfect one where, you know, someone's done some crazy build. Or I think in the UK, you often see builds, but they're builds in association with someone. So I'm trying to think of an example. Jethro
Bovington
has a 996 in Litchfield.
Yes.
So he's like, we're putting a 991 engine in it, I think.
Yes, I think that's what they did. In a 996, yeah.
In a 996. And just sort of watching that process, you know, this is kind of interesting. It's kind of cool. But that's not just him going, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to start funding the bills. It's Litchfield, I think, probably doing a calculation going, we might be able to sell a few of these or it's a fun marketing project or whatever. You know, they're taking on some of the overhead as well.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I have no idea. I suppose there's a multitude of ways that they can sort that out. And of course, Jethro has got a lot of reach. So I suppose from a commercial point of view, it makes a lot of sense to do that for them. Or it might just be a lot of fun and the Litchfield guys, Ian, has got enough cash and says, yeah, cool. Or Jethro's got enough cash and he's paying full retail. I don't know. But
lots of the builds I see, there's a commercial side. And I'm not saying people are like trying to swindle anywhere or anything. It's just purely if it's on YouTube, there is a commercial side to people on YouTube doing crazy projects. Because they can offset the costs and they're creating videos and all that sort of stuff. So it sort of makes sense to do something.
Well, isn't the whole American, you know, you watch any of the American car shows and they build something crazy and you think, whoa, that looks crazy. And then you see it doing 20 miles an hour through the car park and the guy's wrestling with it at 20 and you think, geez, okay,
well, all
it
the
looks
SEMA
cool.
Builds.
The SEMA builds, man, you know. Yeah, 490 kilograms of filler on them and stuff. Well, I mean, I don't know that from experience, but yeah, they don't have to drive well. They just have to look good. And we've had a few cars that have come in and look great, but drove like crap because of what was going on with them. And in fact, one of them, well, you know, the guy sold the car, caught fire just as he sold it and stuff. And you think, yeah. But so, you know, that can happen. But yeah, commercial element of it, yeah, possibly. Yeah, there's a lot of ways of sort of, you know, doing these things, but it's about having fun. And for us, that's still Workshop 77. So we can have the fun. We can do these builds. We can have somebody come along and say, let's stick an LS3 or an LT1 or something LT4 into a roller. And I'd love to do it. But I won't be paying for it.
Yeah, so what?
Because I've got too many car projects.
What's that conversation look like? if someone comes to you now? Because I know you've been through a few sticky situations on these sort of things. And
yeah, well, I mean, we still would for the right person. Yeah, we're still doing it. We've got, we've got a little electric Cinquecento, which is kind of stalled a bit because they're having a bit of problems with the electrics, the kit we bought. Just various issues about overcharging and et cetera. But as sort of the EV market and especially the EV conversion market has sort of evolved slightly and people realize the risks now, these risks are trying to be sort of mitigated. And this was one of the early kits that needs sorting out. So we have that. We're doing, in fact, the guy's in tomorrow, but we got an E9, lovely, you know, really cool customer. We're doing an E9 for him, but he's decided he wants an S54 swap. So we'll put an M3 engine into it.
But, I remember seeing that car.
Yeah,
I think you posted it. In fact, I think the last time we spoke about E9s, about how like that shape is super cool.
Super cool. But we don't really want the 3-liter CSA, CSL engine in there. And this is entirely his call. And we will do it for him. But he's a good dude. He's got a cool vision. And we will work with him through this process. So he's patient with us. And I suppose we would be with him. And it'll be a lot of fun and we'll see what happens. And it shouldn't turn itself inside out, but we'll continue to look at it as we go down the line. But there's going to have to be a lot of prototyping engineering work that goes on with that. And I don't know if that's an Osher car or a Workshop 77 car. It's the distinction between those two shouldn't really matter. It doesn't. He wants a car. He's got a cool concept of what color it needs to be, wheels and bumpers and trims and stuff. And we're really looking forward to it. We've had a lot of welding done, a lot of panels on that car. And we now have a right-hand drive E9 shell that he'll come in and have a look at tomorrow. And then we will look at the donor and how we do that. You know, do we buy a whole M3 or do we just buy the engine? And we take the whole M3, we can use all the drivetrain, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then make sure it's all good. And then if it has to go through IVA, then we'll get it through IVA or something. You know,
is that going to go on to the original chassis?
It does. So, yeah. So we haven't modified or cut anything. So that should keep it safer. You know, I'm very conscious and aware of some of the modification works that happened and does happen to these cars that actually in the UK DVLA is fairly tolerant. You know, you try and do what we do to cars in Belgium and get away with it, or Germany.
Yeah.
No way. You know, I know guys that were driving over to Wörthersee and stuff and their cars were being seized on the way there.
Really?
Yeah, stuck on a trailer and that's it. You know, get out of here. That car's illegal because it was an old Merc on airbags. And they said, yeah, no bueno.
That's funny. Like, I know.
And they're super strict, man. The guys pitch up there with rulers and all sorts. The cops bloody measure these things and it's illegal.
Like if you're in the country and you can't register it, I thought that's one thing. But if it's registered somewhere else, you'd sort of think that, like, I can see how you can argue both sides and go, yeah, but it's still dangerous.
It's
like,
dangerous. Yeah. I mean, well, that's their argument. It's dangerous. I mean, I don't know how dangerous it was or is, but that's their argument. And they're super strict. I there was that thing that actually Haggerty's did a little write-up on, but a guy did an EV conversion to a Mini. And I'm paraphrasing a lot of this, but he effectively drilled a couple of holes through the bulkhead, through the firewall for the cables, to run the cables. And DVLA said, no, you've altered the structure of the vehicle. So now it's invalid. And they said, oh, no, we'll weld the holes up and stuff. And they went, no. And I think they just dug their heels in. And I think the car's on a Q plate now, which is a real shame because it was a proper little Mini. And they could go strict like that. So I am always sort of pretty conscious of it. And it's all fine when it's fine. But what happens when you're in a car that's modified and you haven't declared any modifications or you're claiming it's still a stock standard car, and then you run over somebody crossing at a pedestrian crossing or something, and then the insurances get involved, the insurance isn't going to let it slide. You know,
no.
You've got 16 million quid to pay out to this person for life support for the rest of their life, or, oh yeah, mate, it's modified. And you didn't declare. So we're very aware of that. And Jeremy and I do spend quite a bit of time looking at the legalities of these cars and backdating and, you know, modifications, et cetera.
So what other stuff have you done on the Defender?
Well, the Landys. So, I mean, you know, I suppose most of it is from the outside is all about design. There's some slight distinctions and changes. We do some of the interiors for a couple of Land Rover places. And, you know, I wanted to go the other way to what they do. I wanted to go as a friend of ours, Matt Bishop, said, a bit more pims and a little less pimp. And so there's no rope wrapped around the things, and it's a little less Lara Croft, a little less James Bond, Terminator style. So we've gone a bit more yacht club type style.
Okay.
But, it's just smoothed off. It's clean. It's what we designed, I suppose, at Osher. You know, we use the phrase clean and fast, and fast not necessarily being speed fast. It's just sort of clean and efficient.
Yeah.
And we've tried to do that with the Landy. So aesthetically, it looks slightly different. Nothing is really from a parts catalog. There's a lot of companies making parts catalog stuff for Defenders. We could have bought YPAC lights and you know, various door handles and carbon fiber look stick-on parts.
Yeah.
But we got rid of all of that. On the interior, on the LT, on the 110s, and we decided the 110 was better than the 90 for these because I want them to be usable as well, you know. So I want to be able to throw a family in the back and or kids in the back and stuff on the behind in the station wagon. But it's LT1, so the 6.2 liter, V8, which is pretty big. It all sounds huge and stuff, but we actually get about 28 miles to the gallon, so not terribly inefficient. It's direct injection, you know. So that's why we went away from the LS3, you know, modern engine. And 8-speed auto. So that's, I suppose, ostensibly the biggest changes, but then we have to compensate with pegging the diff so that the power can, we can handle the power because it's 600 Newton meters of torque and 450 brake.
It's quite a lot.
It's a lot.
Off-roady, you know, tires.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Now, we got bigger wheels, so they're 18-inch wheels. We've had them made, so they're slightly wider, slightly bigger. We've got bigger brakes. We've had AP Racing custom make the brakes for us. So all of those sorts of changes. But it just needs to be a bit more comfortable to be in because Defenders are notoriously uncomfortable places to be. We're trying to bring a bit more of modern-day Range Rover into an old Defender and trying to merge those two slightly, but then also getting some power that we can use, but drivability. So, and then the style distinctions. So ever so slightly different.
Are you keeping all suspension, like steel springs?
No. So we've gone tractive suspension on these.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And, so it's got the G sensor, which we mount, and we've opted away from, I hate screens. I dislike screens immensely. So we've got the little selector on a five-way switch, which is what Roof do as well for the same setup, they run tractive. So there's no screen, so we can program it. We can change it up, but there's five options that you can have. So,
which is actually quite a lot.
You kind of want three. You know,
I kind of want one, five, or in the middle, as you say.
Exactly that, yeah.
You don't want, why would you want two or four?
Comfort, sport, and race or something, you know. But so we've got five options and of our testing so far is really good.
And is there quite a lot of variability between those settings?
Yes, there is. Yeah. And as long as you can have, you know, I think that there have been some changes to their systems. There wasn't as much travel between them, but now because it's all just software derived, you know, you can make the valves open up to maximum. So on maximum, it is maximum travel, and on minimum, it's practically rock hard and everything in between. But then you can also change how fast it responds and reacts and comes back, rebounds and various things.
How is it because I guess the spring stiffness makes a difference, but like low speed, does it do that thing where the wheel's just kind of like, or is it kind of douche, 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 douche?
Well, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Not really, man. But
like you watch a rally car.
Okay, on the road.
And the wheels just articulate. Like at like 0 miles an hour.
Well, we got a live axle on these, and you know, so you still end up with that full sort of axle across the back, and it is an off-road car. But the big thing is that you do away with that sort of nose-divey element. You know, I've driven some cars that are supposed to be super sorted Defenders, and you go into a roundabout, and the first thing it is trying to throw you out the left-hand side, and then you turn in a little bit more, and the next thing you know, you're diving into the middle of the roundabout, and you're sort of, you know, alternating between extreme left and extreme right. And you're kind of going around a roundabout like a 50p piece, you know, super right, super left. And this takes away from that because as soon as within 6 milliseconds, it's detecting the nose pitching in, it stiffens that shock and it only stiffens that front damper. So you end up with a bit of a flatter ride going around the corner. So all of our testing so far has been pretty positive and I'm quite happy with it. Because the condition of the roads, again, you know, they're awful out there sometimes. So
And the interiors all look really cool. In all the cars you've done, and you've done some fun prints. We're looking at some fun prints,
yeah,
that you've done. And taking that process in house, have you learnt a lot about interiors and leathers and all
yeah.
sorts of things?
Yeah, we definitely have. But I mean, it's so much better having it in house for us because Julie is not only incredibly experienced. She used to trim jets. For a company called Jet in Switzerland, and the tolerance levels there and some yeah. of the interiors. I think one of the most expensive interiors they did was $350 million to trim a jet. One off jet, big Airbus A340. It's an Airbus A340 for one guy, one family. Wow. It's been featured in magazines and stuff, but I mean, I think the jet was $220 million and the trim was $350. But a lot of work. So we can use Julie's experience as well. But it means we can go downstairs and we can sit in the car and we can play around with it. And we can work there. And a number of these interiors have been redone because we've done something and I've gone, it doesn't quite work well enough. Yeah. What Land Rover did back in the day, and the reason they've done it is perhaps, they want to be able to hose it out. So everything's made out of plastic with giant rivets and stuff on there. And we've tried to smooth all that out. And Alcantara headliners and various things, and for us that just works better. But it's also it looks a bit more luxurious, and we can have Julie go in there and fit it out, and we can say yeah no and chuck it into the reject pile if it's a no, and start again and modify. So yeah, very very useful doing it in house. So we've developed our seats ourselves. Also based on some of my experience, I've been in a couple of Landys and they've got these giant big Recaro race seats in the front there. And on paper, you think that's cool. It's a nice big bucket seat and yeah, cool. Except the wings on each of the seats are, because it's such a small cabin really, and they touch each other. And if you're sitting in the back, all you're doing is staring right at the back of a big bucket seat.
That's
so,
true.
So we wanted to do away with that. So we do have a bucket seat, which we've designed and sort of modified ourselves. And I think it works quite nice. It works well. It they fit the vehicle. They look good in the vehicle. They're comfortable. They're customizable, and you can move them around and adjustable. So I like it. And we've tried to go for there's the same theme across all of our cars. There's the same sort of design language across all the 911, Defenders, regardless of it being a 90 with a 3.5 Rover, which we have in the first little Safari spec one. And that was just to keep the engine in the family. We wanted to keep it within the Rover sort of family. So we have that. So they kind of look the same. They share the same sort of design across all of them, really. And similar sort of color palette. And then the same seats throughout.
Your customers and the people, pitching for these things, have you noticed a sort of distinction on the Land Rovers, when you're like, keeping it within the family, using a sort of an engine that fits versus, let's say, an LT1. Do people care on that car?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I think it probably is personal. I mean, we've had positive feedback from both.
Yeah.
It's a Rover 3.5 V8. But it's on Holley EFI, so it's got electronic fuel injection on there, and it's a lot more modern, and more usable. And I think that's most important for people. Probably got about 180 brake, so significantly down on the LT1. But then a lot of people look at it and go, "Oh, LT1." And I got to sort of echo what a friend of mine Jens says at Zenvo. He's what are they doing? Quad turbo V12.
Yeah.
6 point something. And I'm like, yeah, man.
Rowdy.
Yeah. And I love it. And I love the fact that Jens thinks that that's the way to go, because, I respect him for that as well, because I think that's super cool. And I tend to find that most people sort of say the same, when they see our Landy, you can have a 2.2 diesel in there, which is belching out huge amounts of soot and smoke and crap, or 6.2. And we could also fit the 5.3, but we decided to go with the 6.2 and perhaps it's overkill, but I've got to say, on the whole, everybody looks at it and goes, oh, cool, 450 brake. Yeah, 400. We could turn it up, but I think equally it's more than enough and it doesn't need turning up. Although I'm not trying to do numbers, it's never been about trying to get.
It's not the car.
No, it's not the car to do numbers on. I mean, I see people saying, 550 brake, I'll have a Defender, and you think, wow, sounds dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
450 sounds dangerous. And it could be, it could get you into a world of trouble if you were not using it properly. But yeah, anyway.
So. Where does your head sit on power figures for something like a Defender or even your daily, right? You've got an RS6, is that right?
Yeah.
So I've got the E63 and I love the V8. Like, I love the fact it's a V8.
So do I. I love V8s. V8s for me.
V8 to yours.
Yeah.
But after, I don't know, whatever it is, a year now and 10,000 miles or something, I think the more miles I do, I go, this is a bit silly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But like, and like, I think I would have, if I could do a direct swap, I would have a slightly less silly engine.
Yeah, every now and then I do think it's excessive because I had hit a pheasant the other day, so it's having some repairs done on the bumper.
That's rubbish.
I know. I wasn't even going, you know, this thing was kamikaze. But so I've just been driving around in the ML for a little while in the M class and probably half the power that the RS6 has got. And it's enough. It's plenty. But I got to say, I do miss the RS6 every now and then, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't help but if I did want to hit the gas, I still drop it into sport mode. I don't need it. I don't need sport mode. But yeah, you drop it into sport mode. But too much power. So power on dailies. I mean, I'm a petrol head, man. I got to have some power.
Yeah.
But I have to say, when it gets up to the hypercar level, I get lost, you know. In the olden days, 1,000 horsepower was like, you know, completely unobtainable. Unless you had a jet engine in the back
or some crazy modified thing that you know is running on like
2JZ and now, you know, the hypercars are 2000, are they? You know, I don't even know. I've lost interest in all of that, but
somewhere between 1 and 2 I think is like where they all sort of sit now.
Yeah, that's where they want to be.
I look at them and kind of go, yeah, previously, I don't know, I think when LAF P1 and all that lot came out, I was like, oh, this is like, this seems really cool.
What kind of power they got? I don't even know.
They're like 1,000.
Jeez.
Which is a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
I'm going to have to Google it because, you know.
But they all got a bit heavier.
Okay. Yeah, of course they did. Yeah.
And now it's interesting watching someone like Ferrari, who's just a master at selling cars.
Yeah.
They sell cars like no one else. Everyone else wishes they were Ferrari in that world.
Okay.
And they've done the SP3.
Okay, yes.
It's basically the LAF powertrain.
Okay.
I mean, it's not quite LAF. It's like, it's iterated a bit since then, but without the hybrid.
Okay.
And they brought that out, whatever it is, 5 years later, 8 years later. And so it's like, you've sort of taken a step back and gone simpler, lighter, less power. But everyone's like, I want that car.
Well, wasn't it a thing that people were asking if they could actually have the hybrid system removed?
Yeah. Well, I think it didn't work.
It's practically useless. I mean, what are you doing? 3 miles? 3 mile range or something? You know.
I think most LAFs had a hybrid system replaced.
Did they?
Early days. And P1s, there's a company, I think it's called V Engineering, who were doing a lot of stuff around the battery packs. Because the battery packs were, those battery packs, if you don't drive them, and it's not even like if you leave them on a trickle charger, that's not enough.
Oh, okay.
You had to drive them or they fail and then it's like 150 grand or something.
I don't play in that market.
People have worked in it. But I look at that space now and it's kind of like gone. I kind of don't care apart from every now and then I see something like a Valkyrie boat. I mean, that looks cool.
Yeah.
Is there one particular one of that lot you think of? Do you look at any of that stuff and go, that's interesting?
Oh, no, it's all interesting. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think when they come out, I think, wow, cool. But I have to say, unobtainable amounts of money for me. So you know, it's like looking at jets. You know, I think a G6 is supposed to be pretty cool, but I've never looked at one. And I've almost got no interest in them apart from, you know, occasionally daydreaming and thinking, whoa, that'd be cool. I don't have 200 million.
Yeah.
I don't even know what they cost. I don't even know.
I find it interesting looking at the details.
Sure.
Because you can go, I see what they've done there. Like the Zenvo, for example.
Yes.
They've got one display that's an analog dial.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
And it rotates around. Yeah.
And then it's the digital dial.
That.
That's just a really nice bit of engineering.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it's not cheap, but it's just a really nice bit of engineering. You go, I like that. I like that. Those sorts of things.
Well, I like, you know, all of those cars, the Paganis, you know, I think.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow. Yeah. First time I saw a Zonda F, blew me away. I couldn't believe that this was, you know, not from outer space.
Yeah.
And it was up in Manchester, actually, and a guy pitched up with one, and I thought, God, you know, amazing, amazing. Still love them. Think they're great.
That's the point in time in the Zonda that I've sort of freeze.
Me too. And Zonda go, F.
Yeah, nothing yeah, after that.
Yeah.
Don't care.
Yeah.
Don't care.
No, I'm the same, dude, and I'm older than you. But
One of the things we covered is you've done some interiors in sort of sustainable materials. And I'm going to put an asterisk because I think this is a sort of little topic in itself.
Circular economy, they call themselves, I think.
So
for whatever that means.
You can now, whether it's clothes or whatever, you can buy, let's say, PU leather.
Yes.
Plastic. I think everyone... as long as everyone's not kidding themselves that that is anything other than plastic, which is made from oil. What are the sort of options in the market if you want to be like greener, and are they better options? What are your thoughts on this little topic?
Well, I think it's gaining some traction. I think there's a large degree of greenwashing. I've just had my best mate's daughter's been over visiting us for a couple of months, spending some time in the UK. And it's interesting to get the Gen Z take on these things.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bit, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I suppose naivety around what's actually happening. You know, it doesn't always make sense. You know, we're throwing away plastic stuff in the seas all the time. We're changing our mobile phones and our iPads and our things, and we're far more consumeristic than we ever were, but somehow we're thinking we're saving the planet. And, you know, for me to make a new product, to mine for a substance and then make a new product from that is not better than reusing what we have. So I would rather reuse what we have. You know, something like leather, I understand why people are sort of against it. And there's obviously the distinction between vegan and no harm to animals and sort of vegetarian and looking for some sort of sustainable planet-saving stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, leather is a byproduct from the meat and the dairy industry. It's biodegradable. You can throw it away at the end of it. It actually feels quite good to me. I appreciate not everybody feels the same way. And I respect the fact that not everybody feels the same way, you know, it's entirely up to them.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't think we should sort of con ourselves at thinking that we're going to save the planet by using something like, you know, these various mushroom leathers and various things. And some of them contain quite a large amount of fossil fuels in there, you know, PU. It's not saving the planet. And instead of being a biodegradable leather type product, which is gone once you've thrown it away and decomposes, et cetera, and potentially even feeds things like mushrooms, you're making it out of plastic, which will be here for the next 10 billion, 20 billion years or whatever it is. I don't know what the lifespan of plastics is, but it's, you know, it's significant. And so there's a bit of greenwashing. I think certain things are pretty cool. You know, I know there is a problem with plastics in the oceans and stuff. I don't know how much of it is marketing, but we have some carpets. We've made carpets for various cars, and we will continue to do so if we can. But they claim they're recycled fishing nets.
Yeah, I've seen
all ocean source plastics, and I think that's great. I think it's great. I mean, I got to say, there's got to be a lot of recycled fishing nets because I've seen a lot of carpet, and you think, oh, that must have taken a lot of recycled fishing nets. But perhaps it's more than, you know, maybe recycled fishing nets is just the catch-all for ocean source plastics or recycled plastics.
I'm going to say it's a little side avenue, but it's just popped into my head, and I thought it's not really correlated. But on recycled products. So my other half studies pollutants in the ocean, basically.
Okay.
She's a scientist in that space. And so I get a lot of information about it. And at the moment, if you buy something that's recycled, so the one that's sort of looking at now, a company has gone and tested a bunch of kids' toys that have used recycled plastics.
Yeah.
And it was some crazy large amount contained a number of chemicals that would brand it as hazardous waste.
Oh, really?
Because if you mix, it's like how the mix of the stuff goes. So if it's clear plastic, you're generally all right because there's not like nasty stuff in it. But if it's darker plastics and black plastic and stuff like that, yeah, often the things that are chopped up, and it could be like old laptops, it could be anything. It could be containers that contain like nasty stuff. It then all gets chopped up, put back together, and then put into
kids' toys.
A kid's toy, for example. And there's a lot of nasty stuff in it. So we're now like, oh my God, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
And you don't know this. Like there's so much.
I suppose there's lead-based paint from the, for our modern generation then, you know, the equivalent yeah. where you think it's all cool, but it's all lead-based or, you know, and lead petrol.
It does. I don't want to, that's literally just an information point. I don't want to sort of push anyone one way or another. But it's like, it's a lot more complicated than it looks. Like yeah. all of this stuff
yes.
is actually really damn complicated.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at like, okay, let's just say leather. At the moment, it is a byproduct.
Yes.
And it literally would get thrown in the bin if we didn't use it.
Yes,
no more cows are grown. It's not quite the right word. But to create leather that we use.
They're not grown specifically for leather.
No.
And the rest of it discarded. No, they're not grown for leather. Leather is literally a byproduct. And I get it. If you're vegan and you don't want cows grown you don't want to eat the meat, then in which case, yeah, fine. But I will say as well then, so we're in Northampton. We're in the capital of the shoe country as well as car country, I think, for this country. And friends of mine are involved with it. And they say that, you know, these vegan shoes that they have, they cannot recycle the soles because of the products that are used in it.
Yeah.
And goes into landfill. So, you know, I think you'd have a different take on it if you thought, well, actually, I think I'm saving the planet by going vegan and my shoes are even vegan. And then you work out that actually you're contributing to landfill.
Yeah.
And it's a completely non-recyclable product, despite what they say. I know these guys in, you know, New York or somewhere, he's pitched up with his old trainers and gone into the Nike shop and said, you're going to recycle these. Yeah. And they were like, yeah, mate.
No.
He goes into the skip out the back and that's it, back into landfill.
I do feel like that we're moving in the right direction on this. Like I think Apple have come out recently and said I think the Apple Watches, I think they're some huge percentage of recycled materials from Apple products.
And no lithium and the various moves. I mean, I'm completely naive.
They basically said they're aiming for, I don't know, in 10 years time or something to source all of the rare earth metals and stuff from recycled products.
Okay.
Because essentially, if you think about it, like, I don't know what version of a smartphone I'm on. 5? Maybe? 6? I don't know. I can't even remember. I don't know how many I've had. Let's say 5.
Okay.
If I want a new one, most of the stuff that you need to make that is in the last 5.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
And actually there's more. So if we can pull it all out and the technology
and reuse
is evolving a lot.
So we're not mining then.
Hopefully, you know, we can do less mining.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we can mine to save the planet.
No.
Is my take on it.
But we do a lot of mining already.
And I will caveat that by saying I am no expert. You know, I shouldn't be lecturing anybody on that because I don't know.
It's a complicated one in the EVs. This move to this building.
Yes.
I know you've literally like designed it and done everything. What were you sort of looking for and what was your approach to building this space?
Well, I wanted something that was... we wanted to be able to own our own building, make the changes to it so that it would help our build process. And we couldn't do that where we were. It was a lovely place to be, lovely place to start, very atmospheric. And with atmospheric, read that with the asterisks, that means when it was cold, we were cold.
Yeah,
and when it was hot, we were catching fire. And when it was dry, it was dusty. And when it was wet, we were flooding. But, you know, it looked really cool. But for us, I just, you know, I have a I have a, I suppose my background from management consultancy means that I want things a bit more efficient, a bit more streamlined, a bit more clean. And that's what we were going for. So less of the hot roddy feel and vibe to it, and a bit more towards what I thought would help us build these cars. And this building is sort of suited to that. It's not some sort of grand fancy building or anything. We do a lot of the stuff here. We have streamlined the business to a degree in that I use best of breed when it comes to subcontractors. So we don't have, I don't have somebody who's doing in-house painting. We'll use a number of companies. There's sort of three companies out there that we would probably use. And that can evolve slightly depending on who's doing their painting and who's doing their management of their business. But we're pretty happy with what we got so far. You know, painting is, I suppose, is different to prototyping or doing in some interiors. So, you know, so having the interiors in-house is quite good. But we have a really good guy who does our looms, and he does a couple of days a week for us. And as and when we need him, we do guys who do the mapping for us, and we use him, and he comes in as and when we need him, who's desperate, by the way, to turn my car up to 720 brake. But, you know, like I need brake horsepower, like I need more than what we got. But yeah, so it does mean that, you know, based on, you know, with the experience that I've got with the guys that are working for me and able to contribute, and Jeremy and Jim and Julie and everybody else, and, you know, we can they contribute to what the build process should be now. And Jez is nice and on top of that, and he can streamline things and make sure that pro side of the business is all running quite nicely, and the space we're in now is suited to that. You know,
it's
so
cool space.
Yeah, well, thank you, man. It's not, like I said, it's not some sort of pretentious showroomy type show off thing. It was just how we wanted it to be. So
I follow the line from the previous place.
Okay.
As in, like, you obviously have like an aesthetic that you like, and that was sort of in the previous place, but like despite the building, etc.
Yes.
Whereas now, like, you've got more space and it's all clean and like it's nice. It's quite a cool place to sort of wander around. And you have a nice variety of vehicles in here.
Yeah, we tend to.
Quite
we
like some of them
do.
To just disappear and be sold and whatnot. But like,
well, I've got but those are cars that we've built and we've done and we've used in particular my own cars. Some of them, you know, because it was a bit of fun, and we workshop 77 them, and we've built these cars and I've used them around a little bit, and now we could do with the space and probably even the cash, and it'd be good if we can move those on and somebody else can use them and enjoy them. There's always quite a variety, actually. We do have, which is nice. It's cool, you know, because it's always nice when something new comes in and we all gather around it and everybody kicks the tires and, you know, talks about what's good or what's bad, or it's the wrong engine or the right engine or, as proper petrol heads do, you know, we'd all do that. We do, you know, next door neighbor gets a car and you sort of wander over there with a can of beer and, you know, kick the tires and say, oh, the GTS, that's the one to have, but not that suspension, you know, so...
What's going on in your head in terms of your sort of personal, what you're liking at the moment?
What, new cars wise or anything?
Anything.
I like seeing classic cars that are being used. I'm still big into the classics. I did a track day recently with Shami de Molligato. He did a thing down at Thruxton and I took the 1970 911 and I drove a couple of the other cars. They drove a GT3, drove the new Dakar on the track in anger. Yeah, the owners are super cool. They just said, jump in this thing. Steven said, smash it around the track. And I came in and he went, no, head back out. So it's not even like he was in the passenger seat. So if I wanted to drive like a hooligan, I could have. And it was in the wet. And you know, very capable, nice cars. They're very fast and stuff. But I have to say, I had so much more fun in my car, despite spinning it twice and getting a couple of big scares and full 360 trying to overtake Jit in his 996 GT2. And I did, and then lost it. Stayed on track though. Full 360 stayed on track. Went backwards at 80 miles an hour and managed to spin it back
praying,
the other way.
Praying, and then you're like, oh no, we're fine.
Yeah, and kept going, you know, dumped the clutch and all we went. But so you know, having driven a couple of different cars there, it was, it's fun to be in these classic cars. I love them. Drove past an E24 the other day that was going into town, and I was practically hanging out the window giving the guy thumbs ups and stuff, you know, like, hey dude, cool, even though I think he had the wrong wheels on there and, you know, all sorts of things. But I like the classic cars, but I appreciate that, you know, it was misty this morning and icy, and I took my little boy to school and I was thinking, sheesh, you know, And it's a lot easier. I wasn't in my daily. Yeah. I wasn't in the Audi. And actually, if I'd been in the Audi, it would have been a lot more pleasant. So it's easy to daily a classic in summer. And it takes cojones to try and daily a car like that in the winter. But I do like seeing them around and about, and I appreciate people that do it. And there's some people I see. There's a guy who dailies a TVR Tuscan.
Oh, nice.
And I pass him every morning, and he's probably, because I sometimes pass him in different cars, so he doesn't sort of recognize me by my car, but he's thinking, why is this donkey bloody giving me the thumbs up again or hanging out the window? And there's a guy who looks like a little Morris Marine or whatever it is, and he dailies that, and I'm like, dude, you know, and it's cool. But
it's funny, the sort of like in between manufacturers, like thumbs up. So like I'm say a car person. I think I can say I'm a car person. And if I go past a cool car, I'm like, hey,
yeah. Yeah.
But I was in my 911 yesterday.
Which one?
Oh, this one.
This one.
And
the GTS. The one
and
to have.
Went past someone who was in an A110. So an Alpine A110. And I was like, you don't see very many of them.
No.
The new shape. And I was like, hey. And then I realized, I was like, he's just seeing some Bellend in a modern, brand new 911. Like, he's probably not registering that person is possibly a car person. He's like, they just have a new Porsche. That is a...
Yeah, yeah, but the thing is, he's got to be a car person as well, doesn't he? If he's in an Alpine, he's a car person too. So he probably does get it. But I have the same thing. But you know, all classics, and then I forget I'm not in the Defender, and I'm waving at other Defenders. And you think, oh, wait a minute, he's going, why is that donkey in a bloody Audi waving at me? So
I always take those things as like a massive positive. It doesn't matter what I'm in, anything, and if someone's like, hey, cool, you're like, oh.
Thanks, dude.
Nice.
Yeah,
cheers.
Yeah. So, what do I like? Classics.
Any particular classics? I remember
anything being used. Anything being used. I suppose I have an affinity for the German stuff. '60s, '70s, '80s. And then I was at a workshop the other day. We're doing a trim job on a guy's 1928 Bentley. Super cool car, and he's got all the cars as well, apparently, and not shy to drive them. Him and his mate, they take them out to South Africa. And they based themselves there, but I think they did something like 15,000 miles of driving all the way up through Africa in these pre-war Bentleys.
That's cool.
And I've seen some videos, and they're smashing them. You know, there's a support vehicle in a Land Cruiser behind them, and there's no way they have to keep stopping for him to catch up in a modern Land Cruiser. And they're over, you know, gravel roads and stuff, sending it. And I love that. I think that's super cool.
That is cool.
You sort of go in there, and they had some pre-war Aston, which I don't know, and you think, yeah, man. Eye teeth, I'd love one.
I did a podcast with David Brown. Mm. Do you know David Brown? Does the sort of the Resto minis and the Jags and stuff. And he's done a bunch of really long trips like this, like Paris to Peking type situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, then he'll know this guy because this guy's done them all.
In like an old Rolls or something. And I remember talking to him about it. I'm like, what is it like taking those old cars like on that sort of trip? And he's like, it's great because this is literally what they were designed for. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
When they were built, roads didn't really exist.
Okay, yeah.
So like everything is a dirt track. So they're designed, you know, they've got loads of suspension travel. They've got big hardy wheels. He's like, it's what they do.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I mean, it's still pretty badass though.
it's super badass. Yeah. Well, this chap, so I think he's done it in a couple of different cars from what I gather and all Bentleys and so he's done it in one of his, and he wants to do the other one. He's done it 4.5. They've got to do it in the 8 liter or whatever it is. But I'm not that genned up on it.
Road trips in cars that from the start you think this is going to be interesting are so much better.
Well, isn't that the definition of an adventure? It's fun when it's finished. So you're like, oh, thank God that's over. That was an adventure. That was good fun. And for me, you know, the Landys. You know, it is, we call it Osher Adventure, and it is. I've had so many adventures in those cars. You jump in them and you think, I don't know what's going to happen. We're heading off somewhere. We have to rely on this vehicle, to stay alive effectively. If it breaks down, you're buggered. And what an adventure. So much fun. You know, I've had even the couple of trips out to South Africa with my little boy and up to Botswana. and in the series twos, and it's all of them. Every time you just go down to the river just to have sundowners, because that's a big thing for us, having sundowners, watching the sun, saying goodbye to the absolute heater that's been belting down 48 degrees on top of your head all day long. And, you know, you sort of say cheers to that. And we got a little tracker seat in the front, and my boy jumps in that, and he likes to wear my shirt because it flaps behind him. So unbuttoned, and we get up to, like, you know, flat out, like 25 miles an hour. Dangerously fast at 25 miles an hour, and this thing flies out behind him like a cape, and he thinks he's Superman, and you know, it's an adventure for him, and it's actually an adventure for me too, and I love it.
That is cool. That's cool. I'm looking forward to when mine gets to the age where, like, he's starting to sort of enjoy, and I'll be like, okay, let's go and do something kind of fun. He's not quite there yet. I just get scared.
You'll get there. And it is it's a lot of fun.
Right. I normally wrap these up with five questions. Since you've done the five questions before.
It's probably changed though, because I think last time you said best car and I said F40, and I've changed my mind on that.
Okay. I'll give you a short version.
Okay.
If you can only drive one car for the rest of your life and you have some practical thing on the side. So you could define that if you want, but one sports car.
Enzo.
Interesting.
I think that's, yeah, I've evolved slightly from the F40 to wanting an Enzo.
So sequential gearbox. Interesting.
Oh man, you're talking about, you're talking about details now. I'm just looking at the car.
It's not Manuel.
No.
Fair enough.
Does it need to be?
I don't know. It's your choice. It's not mine. Cool.
I think so. I mean, that's pretty cool. Yeah. And Enzo's.
They are pretty cool. What's the most undervalued car at the moment? What do you think should be worth more? Prices are coming down.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking classic though, or you want?
Classic, new.
Oh man. You know, for me, it's probably got to be a classic. I think I said last time a C107, because they were relatively affordable and they look kind of cool and they kind of perform like a modern car should. I still like those. They're still pretty cool, but you know, the old BMs, but I'm older now. So old for me is still 70s and, you know, it's creeping into the 80s, but old is 90s. It was my 30-year school reunion the other day. And I couldn't believe it. I was furious. I thought they'd made some sort of calculation error. I thought there's no way I've been out of school 30 years, cheeky bastards. But it turns out I had been out of school for 30 years. So 1993, and you think, well, actually, that's 30 years old. That's quite an old car. But to my mind, you know, my first car was a 1986 Mark II Golf.
Yeah.
And one of our clients has got a Mark II Golf, and for him, that's the classicest car he's got. That's the oldest, classicest car. And I'm thinking, that's not that old.
It's kind of a funny marker, that, isn't it? Because, like, I think I sort of draw the cars I saw as my childhood and then when I started driving and stuff, which was a bit late. That, for me, is like ground zero. But that's modern. So that will always be pseudo-modern to me.
Like a Countach for me.
Because it's like, that was new. I remember that being new. Mm-hmm. It's never going to be like a classic. And I think we all have that point that moves. And you look at people with they might have a classic car collection, but it might just be like, if they're 70 years old, they're like, nah, this is all modern stuff. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I bought this when I was in my 50s. Yeah, exactly. I agree. I mean, Testarossa. You know, I don't particularly want one, but it was on my wall. Countach was on my wall. 959 was on my wall. Those are relatively modern-ish.
Yeah. Have you seen Merlin's Testarossa? Duke of London?
A bronzy. Yes. Yeah. Super cool.
He's like re-skinned it.
Oh, has
so,
he? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So I think it's red underneath.
Super cool.
But that looks, he lives not far from me and I've seen it around a bit. And you're like, oh, well played. That's a good, like, I would never choose that color, but it looks super cool on that shape.
Yes, that's, and for me, actually, that's something I really respect, because it's taking a classic car as well, but then just a little bit of imagination changes it up. You know, when my little boy is old enough to start driving, I wouldn't want him to get his 10 years time equivalent of a Ford Focus or whatever the kids are buying, you know, new. I would prefer it if he went and got something that was, like first ever Boxster, you know, 2005 Boxster. And I'd be like, that's pretty cool. Because in 10 years, that's going to be pretty classic-y.
Yeah.
And
also kind of safe.
It is safe. Yeah. Because, you know, And but try and do something a little bit different with it, like Merlin's done with his car. You know, there's ways of tweaking them that is slightly more imaginative than the standard. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with our Defenders. You know, I'm not painting them black. I'm not putting carbon fiber bits on the side because that seems to be the modern evolution of those. And you go, oh, carbon fiber instead of steel. No, we're trying to change it up a lot so that it you know, we're backdating the dashboard so it actually goes back to what it looked like. I like it when people have a degree of imagination when it comes to these things.
And it's a big decision, isn't it? You're spending a lot of money and I could go the safe option, which is the easy one.
Or the sort of resale option.
And I don't 100% buy that one. That argument that like, if you paint it black or gray, it's easier to sell. It's like, no, if you do it in a brilliant color, like a great color.
Yeah.
It's easier to sell.
Yeah. Well.
But if you get it wrong, it's not so easy.
You did that with your F40, didn't you? And, you know, like as we were saying earlier, you know, people still tag you in on it because it's the only blue one around. But yeah, you're probably right. You know, did that make your car more saleable? I would argue it did.
I think versus
another one that had a similar history. Mint F40 with low miles, never crashed, never driven. Yeah, there's a lot of those around.
But and so I've just got rid of my SC.
Okay.
So like sort of reluctantly, not reluctantly.
Yellow one.
The yellow one. And I don't actually miss the car because I think at some point in time, I'll probably end up with an old 911 or something. But,
okay.
But like, I miss having that color.
Yes.
Because now I've got a bunch of like blue cars, basically. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I like blue, but that was a great color on a great car. It's like the right color on the right car. Like the Bimmer you've got downstairs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like a nice metallic red.
E24, that's a complete custom color.
Really works on that car. And you're like,
Iron Man red. Sick. Iron Man red, we call it. Yeah, over the standard sort of orangey, I don't even know what their color was from factory. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, that was a slight tweak. We've never done a stock color on any of the cars. The Aubergine 911 we built, 05, wasn't Aubergine. Nice. Wasn't Aubergine. It's tweaked slightly. That orange 911 ST with the FIA papers, that is known officially as Faisal Signal Orange, and because it was, you know, Faisal chose the color and it's tweaked. It's if you put two cars next to each other, they're slightly different. It does suit the car. Well colored cars, nicely colored cars.
It just brightens up your day, doesn't it?
The RS6 is purple, and I didn't expect that at all. Yeah. It just happened. Really good, you know, good customer, good buddy of ours. He had it, and I love the fact it's purple.
It's more fun.
Definitely.
5-car garage, unlimited value.
Something pre-war, boat-tailed racer, two-seater.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. I don't know them enough, but you know, maybe
something like that.
That little Aston I saw the other day, or a Bentley. Yeah, super cool. There's got to be a daily in there.
Yeah.
And we're ignoring reliability issues.
Yeah, assuming you've got unlimited sort of funds to keep the stuff running and whatever.
New rangy, full fat Range Rover. I've got to say, I do like those. They're pretty cool.
I do like them.
Yeah.
They're good. They're good. And I have an annoyance about the seats. Have you driven one?
No.
Okay.
I've sat in one and luxurious, but.
If you want to move the seats, this is such like a minor issue, but like when you test driving a car, it's infuriating. They have a little seat toggle thing.
Okay.
But you can change like 100 million things about the seats. But the seat toggles on the side only do forward, backwards, sort of fore, aft leaning.
Okay.
So if you press the button, it brings up a display on screen with all the options.
On the giant 43-inch plasma.
So then you get your finger and you're normally sort of at a traffic light or driving or whatever, and you just want to tweak something a little bit. You put your finger on the screen, you start moving it. And then after about a second and a half, it just disappears. So it actually disappears before you've finished doing
tweaking.
And then to get it back, you have to start the process again. And it is one of the most annoying things I've come across in a car ever.
Sounds annoying.
But other than that, it's a good.
Yeah.
They're good things if you can get insured on them and all that
stuff.
Oh,
yeah, of course that is the problem. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so full fat Range Rover.
Yeah.
Old boat-tailed
Pre-war boat-tailed thing. Enzo. stick the Enzo in there. Although, the sequential box I didn't even think about. You know, this is my dream car, and I haven't even thought about the bloody gearbox. So, am I a petrol head or not?
Yeah, but if you have a vision of a car and you're like, I love that car, then you still want to drive it and whatever. Yeah. And then if down the line you're like, I want something else, then that's that.
Yeah, sure.
You've done that journey. Two more.
Classic 911.
Yeah.
Well, do you know, I love the one I've got. You know, I've done probably 15,000 miles in it. It's been tracked. It's been driven. It's been, you know, I've crashed into pheasants and that thing as well. We got a lot of suicidal pheasants around it. But
and that one is, what would you sort of characterize that?
Well, hot rod early 911. So pre-74 hot rod.
And yours is a pre-74?
It's 1970, but with a 993 motor.
So was it like a T or something?
It was an E.
Okay.
Yeah, back before it had a 993 motor.
Is it a bit wider?
It's wider to accommodate the subframe from a 993. So there were everything on that car was about form over function. Function over form, apart from two things. I deleted the rain gutters, which looks cool.
Looks cool.
And I did the central fuel filler on the bonnet, which the reason for it was at the time I had a 550 replica Spider James Dean thing. And I loved the central fuel filler. So I did the same on this, and I'm sort of 50-50 on it now. Yeah. It's a little bit passe, you know. But
In terms of like real world usage, is it a bit annoying?
No. I mean, although the first time I filled up, I dropped the fuel cap on the freshly painted Normandale's paint and thought, oh, shit. But no, it's not. No, it's not. What I do quite like about it, though, is that it is a bit of a, it's an event. You know,
yeah.
So you pull up and, you know,
and right and in the middle. And you can go left side or right side. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, straight up the middle. Yeah, it's cool. That's kind of cool. But then everything else on the car, you know, it's got the wide arches because it's got a 993 subframe in there. So it's multi-link suspension from a 993, and it's significantly wider than a 1970 car would have been.
Yeah.
So we had to go wide arches because otherwise the disc brakes are sitting just on the outside of the car, which is not advisable. And we changed the front mount so it's fully adjustable and various things on there. So, you know, a lot of work went into that car. And it's a lot of fun to drive, I think, ostensibly because it's light. I mean, everything is slow compared to an RS6 if you're dailying an RS6, an RS6 Plus. So everything is slow compared to it, but it's light. And that's the real benefit, you know, and you forget what lightness is. You know, jump out of that car and jump into a GT3 and go around Thruxton and you suddenly go, wow, this GT3, it's got power, but
it's
just big and fat and heavy and the door cards sit up around your ears practically and you think, geez, you know, there's limited visibility and stuff.
Although if you're spinning backwards towards solid objects, you're probably like, oh, I wouldn't mind if these door cards were a bit higher.
Didn't cross my mind. I was just thinking, how do I save this? And I had my best mate's daughter in the car with me as well, and she was whooping it up. So actually, fair play to her. I did have to check with her how many times we'd spun, because in my mind, that was like five revolutions, but it was just the one.
Okay, dead. Okay, dead. Okay. Okay. Yeah, you're good. Sweet. Dump clutch.
Off we went. So a classic 911, we're in the process of building something which hasn't been announced, and I'll share it with you at some stage,
sure.
But an all carbon fiber turbo, and we'll do a limited run on those. So, you know, I think that would be cool. One of our LT1 Defenders, that's the next car on the list. So I don't know where we're up to now.
Probably that's car fine, number, I think.
Carbon 19 now. I think, you know, they're just such good cars. We have that little Safari spec one. I love that car. That's super cool. Oh, by the way, I'm keeping my cars that are in Botswana still. They're added on my list. So the Series 2s and the Willys Jeep that's out there, that gets to stay on there. So in total, this is my five car in the UK garage. Yeah. You know, I love that little Safari spec car, but the more we develop on these LT1 110s, I think, wow, you know.
Probably have one of them, yeah.
Seats are cool, the wireless charger, you know, all the little mod cons that you need on these cars. Plus the safety, plus the usability and the drive. And I'd have to have one of those.
Yeah, fair.
You know? So, yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Dude, it's always a blast, man. Thank you very much. It's, pleasure seeing you and talking.
Yeah, thanks very much. Let's get on a little pike round.
Excellent. Cheers.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.